So we come to the sixth of our prophets, the second of our seventh century prophets. His name is Nahum, and from internal evidence, the dates of his ministry are probably or close enough to what I can offer you there, 620 to 612. He's only got one chapter. It's a very brief prophecy or scroll. This is, we did this last week, so pardon me not going over it again, when we introduced Zephaniah. He, like Zephaniah, is ministering during the kingship of Josiah. And you remember Josiah came in as a boy, but then as he got to maturity, the Assyrians were losing power, and so he wanted to establish, or in fact, it was a bit of propaganda. He imagined the kingdom of David, and he wanted to do it all again and regain the promised land, etc., etc., and reform their religion. And Zephaniah was there supporting him in that. This man comes a few years after Zephaniah, and let's have a look at a little bit of history, but not terribly much. There's our maps. So all we've got is Judah, and most of that's desert. So there's Jerusalem. That was destroyed in 721, 100 years before our time. Are you with me? So that's the area, and there's Jerusalem. Here's a larger map, and there's Jerusalem again, just on the Mediterranean there. And there's the big Arabian desert going down here. That's the Persian Gulf, and Persia, then as now, is all down here. That Persia has gone right up to there now and includes what used to be Media, you know, the Medes. And so Persia is a whopping big country now, all that area there. This is present Iraq here you're looking at. But the point I want to point to is Nineveh, which was made the capital by Sennacherib, because they shifted their capital every now and then, God knows why, rivers silting up and the gods that they worshipped, etc. So that's our map. And Nahum is speaking here in Jerusalem about the collapse and fall of Nineveh, the dark empire, the capital of the dark empire, Ronald Reagan's Moscow. So that's what we've got here. Bit of background and brief. Judah had felt the oppressive power of Assyria since Assyria's westward expansion under Tiglath-Pileser III in 734, which we did when we studied Hosea. His successor, that's the successor of Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, conquered the northern kingdom Israel. In 721, he was replaced by Sargon II, whose son, Sennacherib, devastated Judah in 701. By the time I go over this history so often, you'll all be experts at it, because we looked at this last week. Now, it was Sennacherib who chose to make Nineveh his capital. Nahum, in the chapter we're about to look at, is delighting in the imminent fall of Nineveh, the capital of the empire that had destroyed Israel, annexed the land to the east of the Jordan, conquered Philistia, and for over a century had kept Judah in subjection, even insisting on worship of the Assyrian gods in the temple of Jerusalem. So he's delighting the way any of us would delight if we were under oppression for 100 years and more, and the oppressor was being, I suppose, the delight that happened when the Berlin Wall fell would be an example, or the delight that happened when Nazi Germany was defeated, and people dancing in the streets, they couldn't believe it. And you know those kind of feelings. Well, that's what Nahum is expressing in this poem we're about to look at. Now, Assyria's decline was evident by about 627, which is a little bit before Nahum's time, when Ashurbanipal died. And when he died, there was disturbance, there was unsettled, etc. In 614, Ashur, which was named after, that's why Assyria gets its name from Ashur, which was the ancient religious capital, it fell, in 614, and in 612, Nineveh was captured by the Medes with Babylon's backing. So there's a shift in international politics in this world, and Babylon hasn't yet come to become the dominant, but it's terribly troublesome, and Assyria is caught up with it, and it's declining, and in 612, the capital will fall. That's our background. Now, just we'll do it in one session, of course, one half session. Nahum, since it's so brief. The text must be disturbed because it starts, those little squiggles I've got at the beginning of those verses is the Hebrew alphabet. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, etc. And you all know the Hebrew alphabet. Well, it's a way of writing. You see it in about five or six of the Psalms. We've met it already in other places. It was a way of it's a literary thing. So this is not a simple statement by Nahum. Clearly, we're in a literary place now because the form is. So you've got people picking up what he said, and either he or perhaps a disciple organising it in a clever way as a memorable poem. Because here, for example, that verse there begins with the letter. Let's say in English, A, B, C, D. It's called an acrostic. Well, this letter begins B, G, of course, comes in early in the Greek and in Hebrew, and it's H and W, etc. But it doesn't last right through the poem, and there are letters missing every now and then. So I think we should assume we've got a pretty good text, but it's a disturbed text, and it isn't complete. And that's just, I don't know why I'm telling you that, except that it's a fact. You ready? So you enjoy it as best you can. I wish I could speak Hebrew really quickly and beautifully, because like every language, you know, our languages have got to be heard and felt, and that's I won't go into this, but this is what our trouble is with the new liturgy coming. But don't make an issue of the new liturgy, just do it. It's not too bad. In fact, it's not nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be. But they didn't know. It's just, like, I mean, really, it's not an issue worth fighting anything over. It's a pity, I think, that they didn't get poets to find words that would ring and sound and echo, because in public places, words have to echo, have to touch. You know, it's a special art, and we're not getting that. And it's a pity, but that's about all. Let's get on with what really matters. So here, if I could speak Hebrew, you'd hear the clashing of swords, and you'd hear the flash of light, and you'd get the feel of it, and you'd do what you do when you read any decent poem in our language. You won't get that from me now. You'll get a good translation, and you might get some of it in the English, but it's paltry compared. It's pretty good poetry, this, I'm told, by the people who know Hebrew, really know it. I dabble in it. Are you ready? A jealous and avenging God is Yahweh. Yahweh is avenging and wrathful. So this is his picture of God. At last. And why does he say God is avenging? Because God, in his understanding, you with me? God is the one who is organizing for Nineveh to be dashed and etc. Great, at last. God is avenging them for all the dreadful things they did. Another person might look at it and think, oh, the Babylonians have learnt a bit about warfare and they're pretty clever and the Medes have come in on, you know, we'd have our own way of understanding what's going on and we wouldn't be talking like this. But he's talking like it. So, Yahweh takes vengeance on his adversaries. Again, our enemies are God's enemies because we're God's people. Are you with me? Now, that's pretty, I mean, I'm not stating that as a fact. I'm stating it as their understanding. But that's common in, dreadfully common in history, and is no doubt lurking around still. So, Yahweh takes vengeance on his adversaries. He lays up anger for his foes. Yahweh is slow to anger. God, it's taken him 150 years. So he's not that quick at it, but at last, Yahweh is exhausted the way we are, and Yahweh is acting, and the Nineveh is collapsing. The twin towers are coming down, if you happen to be a freedom fighter or whatever you call the people who did that, or anyone who gets overexcited about the enemy, you with me, collapsing. Depends what side you're on, whether you delight or not. But he's great in power. Yahweh will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. His way is in whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. You know when he did that, crossing the Red Sea, the story. And he dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the bloom of Lebanon fades. The mountains quake before him, and the hills melt away. The earth heaves before him, the world and all who live in it. Enjoying this? Well, you're not supposed to be, but anyhow, good. Okay. Who can withstand God's indignation? Who can endure the heat of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. The rocks are shattered before him. Yahweh is good, a stronghold in a day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him, but with an overflowing flood. The sentence doesn't end because the Hebrew doesn't end. There's a bit left out there. He will make a full end of his adversaries and will pursue his enemies into darkness. That's where the acrostic ends. The rest of, I don't know what happened, it got lost or didn't get there or who knows. So we're now back to the text. Thus says Yahweh, though they are at full strength, and there are many of them, even so they'll be cut off and pass away. Though I have afflicted you, and I put in brackets Judah, because in the context that must be the you he's talking about, but you don't get it in the poem. Though I've afflicted you, Judah, I will afflict you no more. They've been through a heck of a lot. By the way, very shortly after this, Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, 598. That's only 15 years after this is said. So Zephaniah didn't get it right. Nahum got it wrong. Are you with me? Didn't he? I'll afflict you no more. But later they have to do something to rethink all that. So he hasn't, but he's saying something passionately delighting in the collapse of the evil empire. I've afflicted you, Judah. I will afflict you no more. Now I will break off his yoke from you and snap the bonds that bind you. Everything's looking good. Josiah is making headway. Egypt still hasn't come to strength. Babylon's still shivering. And Assyria's caught up over there. And there's a gap, an opening for Judah to recapture the north and re-establish. So it's a pretty buoyant time in Judah, and Nahum is part of that. Yahweh has commanded concerning you. Now, who's the you here? Well, it's the king of Nineveh, the emperor of the Assyrians. Your name will be sown no longer. From the house of your gods I will cut off the carved image and the cast image. You know the difference. I will make your grave a place of insult and reproach. The last thing a king dies, you'd expect honour and big monuments. And no, it's going to be absolutely just wiped out and destroyed and despicable. Look, he says, on the mountain, the feet of one who brings good news. Remember hearing that somewhere?
Yeah.
Isaiah. So there's echoes, they're learning. Okay. Who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, O Judah. They haven't been able to celebrate them for a while. Fulfill your vows, for never again will the wicked invade you. Never again. will the wicked invade you. They are utterly cut off. A scatterer has come up against you. This is Nineveh now, the city. Guard the ramparts, watch the road, gird your loins, collect all your strength. For Yahweh is restoring the pride of Jacob, as well as the pride of Israel, north. Though ravagers have ravaged them and ruined their branches, the shields of the warriors are red. His soldiers are clothed in crimson. The metal of the chariots flashes on the day when he musters them. The chargers, the horses prance. The chariots race madly through the fields. They rush to and fro through the open squares. Their appearance is like torches. They dart like lightning. He calls his officers. They stumble as they come forward. They hasten to the wall, and the defensive shield is set up. The river, that's the Tigris River on which Nineveh is, the river gates are opened and the palace trembles. It is indeed, it is decreed that she be exiled, her maidens led away, moaning like doves and beating their breasts. Nineveh is like a pool whose waters run away. Halt, halt, but no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There's no end of treasure, an abundance of every precious thing. Devastation, desolation, destruction. Hearts faint, knees tremble, loins quake, all faces grow pale. What became of the lion's den, the cave of the young lions, where the lion goes and the lion's cubs with no one to disturb them? The lioness torn enough for his whelps and strangled prey for his lioness. He's filled his caves with prey and his dens with torn flesh. See, I am against you, says Yahweh of hosts. I will burn your chariots in smoke. The sword shall devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall be heard no more. Woe, city of bloodshed, utterly deceitful, full of booty, no end to the plunder. I'm not commenting on this because there's nothing to comment on that I know. I'm just giving it to you as best I can in one go. You'll never read it again, but at least you'll know you've read Nahum. and get the feeling of it, and that's enough. The crack of whip and the rumble of wheel, galloping horse and jolting chariot, horsemen charging, flashing sword and glittering spear, piles of dead, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without end. They stumble over the corpses. All cheer. Hooray! Right, that's because of the countless debaucheries of the prostitute. It's the city, that's the Nineveh. Gracefully alluring, mistress of sorcery, who enslaves nations through her debaucheries and peoples through her sorcery. Well, you can apply this to countries today. You can apply it to us. I mean, this is not irrelevant. Countries whose trades are totally, living in luxury while the rest of, it's not irrelevant. It's just hard to say much about it until you... I am against you, says Yahweh of hosts. I will lift up your skirts over your face. Don't look if you're under 17. And I will let nations look on your nakedness. The imagery is obvious about the city. And kingdoms on your shame. I'll throw filth at you and treat you with contempt. This is Yahweh. And make you a spectacle. Then all who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. Who will bemoan her? Where shall I seek comforters for you? Are you better than Thebes that sat on the Nile? And he reminds them of their history. With water round her, a rampart, a sea, water her wall. Cush was her strength. Cush is that area, you know, like Sudan, Ethiopia, God knows where, south of Egypt, the end of the world in the southerly direction for them. The 25th dynasty, we talked about this once before, in Egypt was actually Kushites from there. They came in and overtook the empire. So, but that, so Thebes was destroyed on its river, the Nile. So why not Nineveh on the Tigris? Egypt too, and that without limit. Put and the Libyans were her helpers. Put is one part of Libya, and Libyans is another group. So Libya's always been tribal, and different tribes make up the country that we now know as Libya. Yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. This is Egypt. Even her infants were dashed in pieces at the head of every street. Lots were cast for her nobles. All her dignitaries were bound in fetters. And I've given you the history behind that. 663, Ashurbanipal, who died in 627, sacked Thebes, which never recovered from that devastation. And if you go there now, you see the temples, and they're still wrecks. And that goes right back to this time. Nineveh is going to suffer the same fate as Nahum sees it. And he's right, it did. But you can see a lot in what he's saying is not right, can't you? Like, not factual, I mean, or didn't happen. But he's caught up in the excitement of this. You also will be drunken. You'll go into hiding. You will seek a refuge from the enemy. All your fortresses are like fig trees with first ripe figs. If shaken, they fall into the mouth of the eater. Look at your troops. They are women in your midst. The gates of your land are wide open to your foes. Fire has devoured the bars of your gates. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your forts. Trample the clay. Tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mould. There the fire will devour you. Your sword will be cut off. It will devour you like the locust. Multiply yourselves like the locust. Multiply like the grasshopper. You increased your merchants more than the stars of the heavens. The locust sheds its skin and flies away. Your guards are like grasshoppers, your scribes like swarms of locusts, settling on the fences on a cold day. When the sun rises, they fly away, and no one knows where they have gone. And to complete the prophecy of Nahum.
He's a bundle of joy.
Your shepherds are asleep. A king of Assyria, your nobles slumber. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. There's no assuaging your hurt. Your wound is mortal. All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you, for who has ever escaped your endless cruelty? We did it because it was there, but this has been treasured, part of their heritage. Why? Because of the, I suppose, I mean, I'm only guessing, and you have your own observations. It's a statement that the enemies of Israel won't finally conquer, that God won't allow evil to go on forever. They will have to suffer the consequences of their dreadful empire, and it was, and their behaviour and the way they killed people, and you've just read some of it that happened at their hands in Egypt. Well, why not? And what's happened in Israel we've seen. So it's an exciting statement of, isn't God wonderful? He's slow, but so if we keep believing in God, he'll come and rescue us, etc., etc., etc.